Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the John Teeter case. Did he truly come from the future? Is the supply of oil peaking? Is free energy being withheld from all of us? More with Jim Marrs above Top Secret next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Jim Marrs. Jim, even though it's kind of bizarre, time traveling in the future will probably be possible. So I guess it would be then possible that they would come back once in a while, like a John Teeter could, wouldn't you think?
It certainly makes sense to me. And again, if you keep up with some of the cutting edge of quantum physics and some of the thinking of people who are looking into time travel, there's several serious people who are saying that we may indeed have time travel, operational time travel, within 30 years. And, of course, I don't have to tell you that if they are theoretically saying we might have something in 30 years, that means probably in some deep, dark, secret government lab that they probably already got it because, you know, we had a lot of stuff before it became public. And it does make sense. And another thing that Teeter said that is now becoming more and more accepted in scientific circles is that ever since Sir Isaac Newton, we've always thought of time as like a straight arrow. You know, it just goes one way. You can go back, you go forward, but it just goes one way. And if you can jump ahead, you're in the future. And if you jump behind, you're into the past. And, of course, that brings up all of the paradox questions. If you did go in a time machine and you went back to the 1800s and you showed them how to make a car and they accidentally ran over a person and killed him and that happened to be your great-great-grandfather, are you going to exist?
You know, the grandfather paradox.
Exactly. So, but he addressed this and he says what a lot of people are coming to, which is, and scientists also, that we live in a multiverse. That there is a whole myriad number of timelines. This is a bad analogy, but like an old 33 RPM record, okay, with all these grooves, and every groove represents another timeline. Now, the problem is we are like the phonograph needle. We're only in one groove, so that's the only one we know about. And we hadn't quite figured out that all these other grooves exist, much less how to jump from one groove to another. But if you've ever accidentally bumps up against an old phonograph and it goes and it skeets over, you're in a different groove, right? So theoretically, you could get into a separate timeline, and then this takes care of the paradoxes because in the timeline where you go back and you run over your great-grandfather or grandfather, then in that timeline, maybe you don't exist. But then there's other timelines where you do exist, and things continue to be pretty much as you knew them to be. So I don't know. It's a fascinating thing, and I know for certain that there are people working on this. And unfortunately, this gets into an area which probably is of great interest to the military and to the intelligence community. So we really are not getting the full spectrum of knowledge or experimentation that's taking place.
Jim, a few months ago here in the St. Louis area, happens when I'm in Los Angeles as well, I filled up my car, $60 for gasoline, $60.
Really?
Now it costs me $17. What's going on?
Well, it kind of makes a mockery out of this idea about peak oil, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
If we're running out of oil, then why is the price back down low? And, of course, they'll give you all kinds of rationales about it. But of course, it was all phony anyway. Here back in the summer, when gasoline was here in Texas, where it's always, you know, has been historically cheaper because we got a lot of oil and gas around here, plus we're close to the Houston Ship Channel, it was up nudging up to $4 a gallon. And yet, at that very time, and a lot of people thought that was because we were having some sort of a shortage of gasoline, but that's not the case because I checked with people down in Houston. They said the tank farms down there were full, and that I even heard from an oil company executive that there were tankers steaming around in circles out in the Gulf of Mexico because they didn't have any place to come in and offload the gasoline. And this is the same thing that happened back in 1974 in the first great big oil shortage, which I also dug into and realized that there was no shortage. The tank farms were full, and they also had tankers steaming around in circles because they couldn't offload the gasoline. So it's all a manipulation. It's all a manipulation. But if indeed oil is peaking, there's no more, we're going to run out, then why are we suddenly seeing $1.60 a gallon gasoline?
Yeah.
That's what it's down here in the little town near where I live. It's $1.60.
You know what? And you know what's so sad, Jim, for the automobile industry? This is the point where cars should be selling like hotcakes when gasoline is this low.
Right.
And it's not happening anymore.
Well, nobody's got any money because there's no more credit. And it makes me wonder, before all this became common knowledge, which is what, probably starting about September, was this all this $4.50 a gallon gasoline back during June, July, August, was that nothing more than price gouging by people who knew that we were getting ready to go into this slump?
So they made their profits while they could.
Exactly. In fact, don't hold me to this because I'm a little hazy on this, but I'm almost sure I read that I think it was Exxon that recorded record profits.
Record profits in the billions, in the billions.
Yeah. So see, folks, we're just getting jacked around. We really are, and it's by the same financial elite that brought you the Great Depression. And the crash of the stock market in 1929. But see, George, and I think you'll agree with me on this, it's like the philosopher George Santayana said, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And we're just repeating it now.
Over and over again.
Because nobody goes back and pays attention to what's happened before. And when people like me try to tell them, look, it happened before and it's the same bunch and they're doing it again, well, I'm just a conspiracy theorist. However, remember my motto, George. If you can prove it, it's not a theory.
That's right. And you know, and you looked into also, as we've talked about in this show, oil fields that somehow were depleted are replenishing again.
That's true. That's true. And there is a growing belief in scientific circles, particularly in other countries where the science is not so wedded to the gas and oil lobby, that this whole idea we've been taught about fossil fuel, that it's dinosaurs and ancient tropical forests that have been mushed under the ground for millions of years and it creates oil. Apparently, that's not really the case. They think that oil now, because they found oil in strata that does not go back that far and that does not have any record of having organic matter there. And so they are now believing that oil is, I don't know, you might call it the Earth's blood, or it's the product of some sort of a hydrogen cracking process that takes place deep within the Earth, and this oil seeps up, and as it seeps up, it fills into caverns and underground caves and passages and stuff. And this is why back in the 1800s, when they first realized that oil was something that was profitable and something they were going to need in the industrial age, and they began to scientifically try to study oil, they found organic matter in it, and that's where the idea came from that, well, it must be just compressed dinosaurs, animal life, and plants. But they are now realizing that that very well may not be the case. But I'll tell you something, George, I really don't want to go there, and I don't want to try to push the idea that we're awash in oil, even though that seems to be the case, because we are choking ourselves to death as a society on the pollution from oil and gas. We really do need to go to more to cleaner and more efficient fuel sources.
And less depending on fuel sources.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always going to be a need for oil because a lot of people don't even realize we need oil to make plastics. We need oil to make clothing. We need petroleum to do all kinds of. We need petroleum to make medicines. There will always be a demand for petroleum, but there's no real reason that we should be polluting the air burning it in internal combustion engines. Right now I'm driving a Toyota Prius. And I'm not getting very good gas mileage because I live way out in the country, and we have to drive at pretty high speeds for long distances on state highways, and so I'm only getting 42, 44 miles a gallon. People are getting better than that in the cities because these hybrids have these four electrical motors, and when you are idling or when you are stopping and starting inside city limits, you run off these batteries, and you don't use gasoline. And, of course, they call it a hybrid because it is a hybrid. It's an intermediary step. There's no reason why people who live in the inner city and only travel a certain distance, you know, back and forth to work or go to the store or whatever, there's no reason they shouldn't be running an electric car.
Well, and you know, these automobile industry companies that are trying to get this $25 billion from the government, from us, they have to come up with some kind of plan. And I think that if they're going to be given $25 billion, that plan must include going into this alternative energy source for cars. That's what they should be using this money for.
Well, those big car companies have only themselves to blame. There were plenty of people, starting with the Volkswagen, going back to the little Mazdas, going back to the Chevette. The car companies tried making small cars that were fuel efficient, and they wouldn't promote them.
Have you seen the compressed air car that is over there in India and France? I want to do a show on that. I think this is
absolutely
remarkable.
They just run on compressed air.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, and those are great for the city. You know, if you're going to just bop around town in a 25, 30-mile radius, a lot of people don't go any farther than that, Jim. They just stick around town. Those cars would be great.
Well, I'll go you one better than that, George. I mean, you know, we have another problem along with pollution and the high price of gasoline, and that is everybody in this country is overweight, right? And we have a real problem with people being out of shape, overweight.
True.
So my idea is, why don't all the big cities invest in cheap but sound bicycles and leave them lying around all over the place so people just get on a bicycle, go where they want to go, lean against the wall, and go on off. And then when they're ready to go home, come out, find one leaning against the wall somewhere, pick it up, pedal home. You know, and if you're not going too far, not only are you not burning any fuel, but you're burning a lot of energy, and you're going to be trimmer, healthier. It takes care of two problems with one stroke.
Jim, we just did five shows for the Sci-Fi Network, and we taped them many months ago. But in the process of taping them, they had to change some of the opens and intros going into commercials. And so we had to retape some of the segments.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of the months in between, before the show went on the air, I had gone into a massive workout kick. Never been overweight, but I wanted to drop 10 pounds. You know, television adds 10 pounds to you anyways.
Right.
So I wanted to drop 10 real pounds, and I went back into this workout kick. And so I went back on camera a few weeks ago for the reshoots, and they compared it to the other me, and they went,
"You look different."
Oh, my God. These are two different people. Where is he? And so
you don't
what
look
they
the same, George, you got to go out and eat. He did.
Yeah. So what they did, they electronically tried to make me fatter on the second takes.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Simple things that people could do to be in shape. I'll freely admit, I just have not got the time or the self-discipline to get into an exercise routine, you know? So what I find ways to do this. For example, when I worked for the Star Telegram, the editorial offices were on the third floor. So I would simply, unless I was in a rush, I never took the elevator. I climb the stairs.
That's good.
Up and down those stairs, and I go up and down those stairs maybe a dozen times a day. And, you know, that's getting some pretty good exercise.
It sure is. How old are you now?
I'm sorry?
How old are you? Do you ever reveal that to anybody?
How old am I?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I actually have to stop and think about it. in about a week, I'll be 65.
Good for you.
And you know what? all my life, I was told that if you hit 65, that's retirement age, you can start drawing Social Security. And I'll be damned, about 2 months ago, I didn't get a letter from the government, and they said official retirement age is now 66.
That's right.
So, I feel pretty strongly that next year I'll get a letter, and it says the retirement age now to get your full Social Security has been moved up to 67. They're going to just keep it 1 year out of my reach.
You'll never be able to get it. I think at 66 you can still work and make money and collect your Social Security. But you're right. They keep pushing it a year away from you.
That's right. Of course, I'm used to that. Maybe this is where I kind of got a slight anti-government bias. I went to work when I was 13 years old, and I went to work for a grocery store. I was making 50 cents an hour, and I worked hard. I applied myself, and the next thing you know, I was making 75 cents an hour because I got a raise because I was doing good work. And then the next thing I know, they came in and instituted the minimum wage, and the minimum wage was 75 cents an hour. And all of a sudden, my bonus that I got for being a good employee was wiped out because everybody made 75 cents an hour.
Jeez.
And it's been like that ever since.
Hey, Jimmy, where do you get this book, Above Top Secret?
Above Top Secret, you bet. Any bookstore. You can also, I'm sure, order it off the Above Top Secret website. You can get it off of my website, jimmars.com, and off, of course, Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. And I want to tell you, this is you've got a copy, George. Isn't it neat looking?
It is. It looks like
corners.
It's a little briefcase.
Yeah, it's a little briefcase. It's got rounded corners. It's got a lot of open space and a lot of bullets and, you know, little indented things. It's a really fun, easy read.
It really is. And, you know, I'm three quarters of the way through it because I got it today back in St. Louis. After we're done, I'm going to read the rest. And just sit back and chill this weekend and have some fun with this after Thanksgiving. You know,
sounds
we're
going to
be
George.
Live at Thanksgiving night. What passed by the space shuttle Atlantis, Jimmy?
Well, they tried to say it was several different things, but I think the bald-faced fact is nobody knows for sure. It was just one other incident of several, most of which are not covered in the book because of space considerations, but where the astronauts have reported seeing things flying around, and then they try to come back retroactively and say, oh, well, it could have been a booster stage, it could have been this, could have been that. Well, sure, it could have been any number of things, but what was it? Well, George, I got a question for you. Now, since you're about halfway through this book, and since you're probably, of all the people I can think of, everyone is probably pretty familiar with most of these topics, but are you finding things in there that pique your interest and that maybe give you a little bit more information?
All of them. I mean, first of all, a Nazi base in Antarctica.
Sounds incredible to you.
I love it.
Facts.
I love it all. Is God an alien? I mean, that's a home run thing. I mean, I've got my own views, so do you, but I mean,
right.
It's a great question. I want to talk with you a little bit later when we come back to about 2012, because you even addressed that.
That's right. What's going to happen in 2012? And again, I don't want anybody to get the idea that you're going to get a definitive answer out of Above Top Secret, but what you're going to do is get a pretty, I would hope, a balanced view of what the issue is. And then you can start thinking about it and think about, well, you know, what is going to happen in 2012?
Jim, your research is incredible. Let me ask you something. Have you ever felt threatened because of the places you go to try to get the answers?
Well, if I have, I've been too dumb and naive to recognize it. I will say that I think the only time I can remember in my entire career that I was overtly threatened was by an associate of Jack Ruby's. And I met him at his invitation at a restaurant one night, and he forgot a cardinal rule of dealing with the media, which is when you deal with the media, you say, can this be off the record?
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back. Plus, now in our phone calls with Jim Mars, because in an hour we're going live to Egypt with Dr. Zahi Hawass, we started Jim Mars early. So we're going to use your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, tomorrow for you Streamlink members, 8 p.m. Pacific time now, get in the room for the Streamlink chat. our guest chatter tomorrow, Ian Punnett. So pop on in and chat with Ian before Thanksgiving. Back with Jim Mars and your phone calls for the next hour. Jim, tell me a little bit about that Jack Ruby story.
Oh, well, it's really no big thing. He just made the mistake of telling me all this stuff and then telling me it's off the record. And I tried to explain to him, look, you're supposed to get me to agree it's off the record. Then you tell it to me, and I will honor the off-the-record portion, you know. So he leaned across the table, and he said, well, if you get my name involved in this, I'll find you and kill you.
that was off the record enough for you, right?
That was off the record enough for me. So
I love it.
And it really wasn't all that much, although there was a fascinating bit to that. He told me how he used to go and collect gambling debts with Jack Ruby for the mob back in the 50s, and he said it was a great deal because if they go and the guy paid up, then they would split some of the money and then send the rest of the money on. He said if it required some violence, that Jack Ruby would, if there was any violence involved, he would like snap into a alternate personality. And he'd just go wild, you know. And then when it was over with, he wouldn't remember anything had happened. And the guy laughed and said, so anytime we had to get violent with somebody, I just kept all the money because Jack didn't remember it had happened. And, you know, that really struck me, George, because it's well documented that after Jack Ruby shot Oswald and they got him upstairs to the police station and he calmed down a little bit, he started saying, what happened? What happened? Tell me what happened. So that's apparently awesome. He just went into that mode. I don't know if that was an MK Ultra mind control or if that was just a quirk of his personality.
What a bizarre, that entire story of the Kennedy assassination is just too strange, Jim.
Well, you know, that was the two things that got me going that very weekend. And I was in college. I was already on a degree plan to as a journalist. And I'd been in Jack Ruby's club. I'd met Jack Ruby. And the two things that really got me was, number one, all the people who said that some people said four shots, some people said six shots, but the consensus was already beginning to congeal around three shots. But they said there was one shot, a pause, and then two shots right on top of each other, kind of a bang, bang, bang. Well, even then, I'd been deer hunting. I knew bolt-action rifles. You don't get a bang-bang with a bolt-action rifle. It takes a little bit of time to cock the bolt, pull the trigger. So it would have to be a bang, bang, bang. And so I was puzzled about that. And I thought, but I was, you know, like everybody else, I was accepting the news as it was unveiling itself through the media. But then on Sunday morning when I'm sitting there waiting on the announced transfer of Oswald to the county jail, and Jack Ruby, a guy who I already knew had ties to the underworld because my fraternity brothers had warned me. They said, if you go into Dallas, you want to get in a high-stakes poker game, look up Jack Ruby, but be careful because he's connected to the underworld. As strange as it seems, in these more enlightened times, at least down here in Texas, we'd never even heard of the mafia. We didn't know what the mafia was. But we knew Jack Ruby was connected to the underworld. When I saw him step out and shoot Oswald, alarm bells went off in my head, and I just said, wait a minute. But one lone nut gets killed by another lone nut, handcuffed to policemen in the basement of the police station? Something's not right about this.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies, Ed in Maine. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi. Hey, listen, you were talking a little earlier about the oil and the tankers circling around out there.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, I've been somewhat suspicious, particularly of the people in this administration and the way that oil prices have gone, more or less been manipulated. I wonder if at this particular point in time, the oil prices aren't coming down because all these alternative energy sources, such as the alcohol and the grain manufacturing of alcohol, they've all put out their big contracts, the bids for farmers to grow all this corn. And all of a sudden there's this credit crunch. And now they're going to have to go bankrupt. And guess what? We won't have any alternative energies because all these companies have gone bankrupt. And what do you guess think about that possibility, you know, manipulating these companies out of business so that now the oil company is back at the helm again? I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, sir.
Thank you.
Right.
Distinct possibility, Jim Morris.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, we've talked all along, whether it's the financial crunch, the credit crunch, the housing balloon or whatever. This is all manipulated. This didn't just happen, okay? And, you know, it probably started back in 1913 when they slipped the Federal Reserve System in on us. By subterfuge, by deceit. In fact, one of the men who attended that meeting at Jekyll Island called himself and his fellows conspirators. Okay, so it's not a conspiracy theory. They call themselves conspirators. And it was all a plan to get control over the money supply of this country, a eventuality that Thomas Jefferson warned us against. He said, if you ever allow bankers to gain control over the money supply of the country, then your offspring will grow up without property in the country we founded. And, George, I don't know about you, but when I drive around these big cities, I see all these people living, renting apartments and renting condominiums and paying on their cars, paying on their... They really don't own anything.
No.
Except maybe some clothes in their closet.
Next up, let's go to our west of the Rockies, John in Palm Springs, California. Hey, John.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Back to JFK. This is on the record. David Ferry, who I knew from the Civil Air Patrol Squadron, Lakefront Airport, pressed in the hands of a then senior cadet when my buddy and I were on the way to Dallas before 63. In our pursuit of the national drill team competition, he pressed in the hands of this senior cadet a phone number and said, when you're in Dallas, you know, if you need anything, call this number. And that was Jack Ruby's phone number. So that connects David Ferry directly to Jack Ruby. Plus, I am awaiting from the widow of a gentleman whose photo I held in my hands that puts Oswald in the same frame of that picture with David Ferry. The people who know already don't need that photo, but it's like the tree in the forest. For those who didn't see it and didn't hear it, they deny that it happened. But for those who need that photo, I will have it soon, because we in the squadron there knew and giggled about all this stuff. We were in the eye of the hurricane in New Orleans between Dallas and Miami.
Did you know Lee Harvey Oswald yourself?
No, sir. But then before he was the Lee Harvey Oswald, I could have met him without knowing. It's only after the fact that one would know that he was. Not claiming that I met him.
Okay.
I'm just saying that I was in about a year and a half after him. Me and my guys were in this.
Okay, so you were a little bit after Oswald. But the thing is, that what you're saying is, and I'm not sure this has been made clear, but the caller is absolutely 100% correct. David Ferry, one of the men that Jim Garrison in New Orleans sought to prosecute.
And I knew Jim Garrison.
Yeah, was the commander of the Civil Air Squadron that Lee Harvey Oswald belonged to. And I'm not sure if we're talking about the same picture, but...
out on bivouac.
Yeah, there is a photograph that was made, has been made public. Public television aired this several years back.
Sure.
It has David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald together. And as the caller said, this was, again, one of these things that for about, you know, 20, 30 years, they said, oh, no, they didn't know each other at all. And of course, that's been proven to be untrue, like so much else in that case.
But I and my other cadets at that age were taken out to do the war games, maybe not with the adult mercenaries, but on the weekends with the squadron activity. And there were two Marines there training us in hand-to-hand and knife fighting. And that explains the fact that the world refers to Oswald as that ex-Marine and not that ex-Civil Air Patrol cadet. Because the world, they don't want the world to know that Oswald was connected through the Civil Air Patrol with Ferry.
Right.
Although, Stone did reveal those couple of things, and the world scoffs at Stone as well as Garrison, and Garrison certainly had it nailed. They just made him a crazy.
Yeah, they're the ones who are actually telling the truth.
Thank you, sir.
You got
and
that.
I know my...
Oh, okay.
I guess he went.
I heard him say thank you, sir.
I was going to ask him a question. I was going to ask what was their attitude towards John F. Kennedy?
Yeah.
And since the Civil Air Patrol is so closely connected to the military, and I guarantee at that time, being a grown man in Texas and already a journalist, that among most of the military people, most of the intelligence people, they not only disliked Kennedy, but that many of them saw him as a threat because he was, he was soft on communism.
Yep, and I also think the Federal Reserve thing had a lot to do with it.
A lot. Kennedy, in June of 1963, issued $4.2 billion in currency, but not through the Federal Reserve System, to which we have to pay interest. He issued it through the Treasury Department States notes. And that was just money that we generated, and we didn't have to pay interest on it. And, George, he became only the second president in U.S. history to issue interest-free money. And the first one was Abraham Lincoln when he issued the greenbacks to finance the war between the states. And I don't think that it's just sheer coincidence that both of those men were shot in the head in public.
Brooklyn, we go. Bruce in New York. Go ahead, Bruce.
Hey, how are you tonight? First, I want to say, George, you've done an awesome job with Coast to Coast.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce.
I mean, really, really great. Getting to Jim Morris, I called up originally to ask you about a chapter in your Fourth Reich book about the treasure trove, because the mystery of René Le Chateau has always, really fascinated me. And I had never known that Otto Skorzeny and the Nazis basically ended up getting all that, whatever was actually there is pretty much, I guess, in their hands. I just wanted to know, how did you connect yourself to that, to that story? How did you find out about it? How did, how did that information come to you? Because I've been following that for a while, and I never knew that. Also, I have another, going to JFK, what do you know about Ruth Payne? Like, her name, I know that, there's a lot to ask here, but she's someone who sort of was a kind of a mysterious figure in the JFK assassination thing. And I just wanted to know if you think that she had any hidden connections. And, I'll just, I put that on the table, and I guess I'll just listen to your answer. Thanks a lot.
Okay, I'll back into it. Start with Ruth Payne. Through her family, she was connected to U.S. intelligence.
Oh,
excuse me.
Okay, Jim?
I'm sorry.
You all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, of course, that's just one of numerous connections to U.S. intelligence that permeates the whole JFK story. Sorry, young man.
That's all right. Go get some water. Walk over there, pick up a little water, and...
And then, as far as the... I like the caller. I've been fascinated with the whole story of René Le Chateau ever since I read that book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Yes.
And I even made a trip to France and went to René Le Chateau and found out all kinds of interesting things, such as the mountain down there that continually, no matter how clear the sky, there's always a cloud over the top of this mountain. And I said, what's with that? And all the locals said, oh, that's where the ships go in and out. What? Yes, and that's when I got on to the story about the fact that Solomon's treasure was looted from Jerusalem by the Romans, of course, during the Jewish revolt of 70 A.D. and when Jerusalem was sacked. And they took a good portion of Solomon's treasure back to Rome, where 400 years later, when Alaric the Goth sacked Rome, he carried the treasure back to his home grounds, which was the Languedoc region of southern France, right where Rennes-la-Château is. Excuse me. And then the Templars, Knights Templars, uncovered the rest of Solomon's treasure that had been hidden away under the old Temple of Solomon, which by then had become the palace of King Herod.
See, I think somebody somewhere, Jim, has a lot of this treasure. They've got it tucked away somewhere, and
yes,
they're keeping it. And, you know, it's probably one of the rich bankers of the world. Who knows?
But there was a Colonel Howard Buckner, who was the medical officer from one of the infantry divisions during World War II, and he picked up the information that in March of 1944, Otto Skorzeny, the famous Nazi commando, led an expedition to the Languedoc region, and on March the 16th, he sent a one-word telegram back to Berlin that stated, "Eureka, we found it." So the Nazis recovered Solomon's treasure, which not only explains how they were able to survive the war with the loot of Europe to possibly include Solomon's treasure of gold, silver, precious stones, but also this ancient knowledge of technology, which may have given them a leg up in some of the more fabulous scientific breakthroughs that they made during the war.
Absolutely. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller in Los Angeles. Joe, you're on Coast to Coast with Jim Mars. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hello, how are you?
We're fine, Joe. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Jim, it's an honor to speak with you. I've read your book.
Which one?
Oh, well, I read your book, Ruled by Secrecy, and I just bought your other book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. And back on the Kennedy assassination, you know, I understand that President Kennedy, he signed Executive Order 11110, which essentially provided for the issuance of, I guess it was silver-backed notes or essentially money that was issued by the U.S. government.
Yes, United States notes.
Right, and the way I understand it is that that executive order was rescinded by Johnson almost immediately after President Kennedy was assassinated.
Let both of you hold for just a second, and we'll be back with final phone calls with Jim Mars. Go take a quick break, Jim. We'll be back with you in just a moment.